Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 12, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Tonight's show is mostly devoted to an interview with David Roediger, author of the book Working Towards Whiteness, just out from Basic Books. Roediger teaches history at the University of Illinois. Before Roediger, a few words, though, about the economic news. Since I'm recording this on Monday, I'm not really able to give you a rundown on this week's economic headlines. A few words, though, about last week's employment report. It showed a growth of 207,000 jobs in the U.S. economy in the month of July, which is more than most people, including me, were expecting. By recent standards, that's a pretty good number, but it's still below the long-term averages. Some on Wall Street were alarmed that average hourly earnings were up rather strongly for the month, at nearly twice the pace we've seen in the previous months. But that just means that workers are keeping up with inflation after months of having fallen behind. The quality of the jobs that were created wasn't necessarily of the highest order. Leading sectors included retail and restaurants. And the Federal Reserve has made it clear that they intend to continue to push up the interest rates under its control. If they keep it up, and if they're really serious, this policy will result in a significant economic slowdown and a reversal of the positive job creation numbers. That won't happen immediately, but this expansion, which began after the recession ended in late 2001, is looking a little long in the tooth. A few words on business cycle language. A recession is when economic activity, meaning things like employment, incomes, and corporate profits, decline together. People lose their jobs and companies go broke. Recessions usually last the better part of a year. When a recession ends, a recovery begins. When the recession's losses are made up, which usually happens in a few months, the expansion phase of the upswing begins. Jobs are created, incomes rise, and new companies are created, and everyone feels a little better. There's been something very strange about this expansion. Measured by the most conventional indicator of all, GDP growth, this has been the weakest of the 10 expansions we've seen since the end of World War II. Companies have been very shy about hiring, investing, or expanding. And that weakness has come in the face of massive stimulus from big federal deficits and very low interest rates. I don't think we've fully shaken off the bursting of the 1990s bubble. What happens when the expansion finally ends could be very interesting. Let's take a musical break and I'll introduce David Roediger. That was a bit of the Prelude No. 1 for piano by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Keith Jarrett. A few years ago, back when he was famous and we sort of had to pay attention to what he said, Newt Gingrich declared that race in America today wasn't what it once was. Today it's all about Tiger Woods. It would be nice if it were true, but it isn't. One angle on race in the U.S. that doesn't get enough attention is whiteness itself. To borrow some terminology from linguistics, white people are considered unmarked and everyone else is marked. Everybody else has race but white people. Similarly, gender is treated as a problem of women and not of men. But despite its allegedly natural appearance, whiteness is as much a social construct as blackness, brownness, or yellowness. Black scholars and writers have known about this for a long time, but it's only been over the last 10 or 15 years that people have started talking about whiteness as an entity with a social history. And one of the major reasons that that's happened is in the work of David Roediger. Roediger first attracted attention with his book The Wages of Whiteness, published by Verso. Another Verso author, the late Ted Allen, contributed importantly to the field, as has Noel Ignatieff, author of How the Irish Became White. Roediger's work looks at labor markets, housing patterns, and popular culture to trace the emergence of whiteness in the U.S. in the late 19th and early 20th century. The earlier book, The Wages of Whiteness, concentrates on the U.S. before the Civil War. This more recent book focuses on the second half of the 19th century and the early decades of the 20th. Irish Americans have played a very important role in the creation of the white race in the United States. Initially despised, the Irish managed to whiten themselves and teach the racial ropes to immigrants who followed them. Aside from its importance as a history of race and racism in this country, Roediger's work is also an admirable model of how to work across disciplines. He takes language and popular culture seriously, but he also takes the pressures of the labor market and American capitalism seriously as well. He examines the roles of sexual anxiety and envy in the emergence of whiteness, too. All in all, thoroughly admirable work. I recorded this interview a week ago today. Let's listen to the first part now, David Roediger.
First of all, just a little bit of intellectual history. A friend of mine who's a historian says that this whole interest in the creation of whiteness, the field of whiteness studies, came about in the 1980s as an attempt to understand the phenomenon of the Reagan Democrats. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, in my first attempt at this, Wages of Whiteness, the introduction actually talks about the book being written in the shadow of Reaganism and to try to understand, particularly for me, it was what's the white worker about? How did historically white and worker get paired? And that was an election in which a near majority of the white working class voted for Reagan and almost of the unionized white working class. And so I think a lot of us in various ways were trying to understand that. Now, there's a much longer tradition of scholars of color trying to understand how whiteness works. For me, all that the critical study of whiteness is making whiteness into a problem. And for people like James Baldwin and Ida B. Wells, whiteness was always, for a long time, a problem. And so there's this long, long, long tradition that I try to capture sometimes of African-American writing, for example, critically studying whiteness. But I think that's right, that the real breakthrough in terms of university-produced books, it came in the 1980s and in response to Reaganism.
And, yeah, what about your personal route into this? What was your the intellectual history that got you into this field?
Well, I was trained in African-American studies. My mentor was Sterling Stuckey, the great African-American historian. And then at a certain point decided that I was going to write labor history mostly and didn't teach African-American studies, although often had a joint appointment, still do, in history and African-American studies. And so when I wanted to understand the Reagan, the white working class vote for Reagan, I went back and just reread all of the things that I had already read in graduate school as African-American history, but tried to think about them in terms of how they also talked about white history and made a problem of whiteness. So for me, the key text was James Baldwin's The Price of the Ticket. But it was within a whole bunch of other readings that were familiar readings to me. Actually, I collected those in a book called Black on White that tries to establish the long roots of the critical study of whiteness.
Let's start with a bit of the history before this particular book begins. Immigration of the Irish into this country was very complicated, and their initial reception was not very welcoming, and then several decades later, they were the avant-garde of whiteness. So could you just review the history of this, the whitening of the Irish, before we move on to what were then called the new immigrants?
Certainly in Britain, in the early and middle part of the 1800s, as the late Ted Allen shows, the Irish were victims of what he regards as racism, and with caricatures, ape-like caricatures, and structural discrimination, some forms of ghettoization. And much of that also occurred in the United States, where there was this tremendous nativist impulse against the Irish. However, at law, and particularly in naturalization law, the Irish were always legally white, and therefore could organize and vote. And using that kind of citizenship power could make a tremendous impact on U.S. politics. And one of the Irish roads to full whiteness was through political mobilization. So in an interesting way, the Irish, I'm beginning to argue now, became the teachers of the U.S. racial system two generations down the road to Eastern and Southern Europeans. So in working toward whiteness, the Irish appear and sometimes appear as racially suspect. There's still a lot of people from the western part of Ireland who are migrating in the early 20th century, and they're considered wild Irish and a problem. But mostly the Irish appear as you put it, as kind of an advance guard of whiteness with this secret knowledge about how race works in the United States. And so as priests, as union officials, as machine politicians, as foremen, they're the teachers of the racial system to Poles and Jews and Italians.
Well, you said that the Irish were already legally white. Who wasn't? Obviously, African-Americans weren't, but who was not white besides African-Americans?
Well, Native Americans, increasingly Asian Americans by court cases from the 1850s on and by exclusion acts from the 1870s on. Mexican Americans in a much more complicated way, citizenship rights recognized by treaty law from 1848 on, but on the ground very often denied civil rights in local places and particularly conflated with Native Americans in order to do that, so that it becomes in a place like California very much about class, also so that, you know, you could have elite Mexican American politicians and landholders who are recognized as white, but then California passes what's called a Greaser Act in the 1850s, which makes certain that the civil rights of poor Mexican Americans are not going to be recognized.
You mentioned the Greaser Act. You review the history of a lot of these epithets, and they're very complicated. Where does a word like greaser come from?
Well, originally it sort of typified a lot of working class occupations where people get dirty, but in the sense that it becomes what the Oxford English Dictionary calls an Americanism, it refers to Mexicans who were on land that the United States took over. And like all important words, it has many, many stories of origin. It's about food. It's about hair. It's about the kind of work that Mexican-Americans were doing, maybe greasing guns during the Mexican War. But what's interesting for me is that a word like that, which is in the middle of the 19th century, coined to apply to Mexican-Americans, to this racialized group, then gets applied to Italians and Greeks and Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans in general. And the book argues that the same thing happens with a word like Guinea, which originally is a slur against African Americans in the 19th century and becomes a slur against Italians and others in the 20th century. So a fair part of one chapter is about racial slurs, but not just in the sense of language, also in the sense of what's going on structurally that connects oppression of people that we think of as clearly not white with people that we think of as European and white.
And then as the 19th century progressed and the sources of immigrants to the United States became considerably more diverse, we had a whole lot of anthropologists and demographers working out racial typologies. I think you enumerate them from about 3 different races to 45 different races.
Right.
Give us the lay of that land. It's a strange form of social science.
In the early 20th century, race subsumed the category that we now call ethnicity, so that there were 3, as some people put it, or 5, races, world races described by color, black, brown, yellow, red, white, and sometimes some of those got collapsed. But then there were also these tremendous breakdowns of European races into either big categories like Alpine and Mediterranean, or into smaller categories like Italian and Polish races, or, as the census had it, Northern Italian races and Southern Italian races. And one of the things that the book labors to do is to remind us that there wasn't a category of ethnicity when people lived this experience. Immigrants lived from Southern and Eastern Europe, lived this experience as an experience that was called a racial experience. And so a goal of the book is to make us realize how important race was even in what we think of as white European immigrant history.
Yeah, the whole idea of ethnicity, we became familiar with that really starting in the 60s, the ethnics, the Kevin Phillips Southern strategy was playing on their prejudices. And, we certainly still think of white ethnics as a distinct category, but that is a relatively recent invention, isn't it?
It's a late-coming category, and in a certain way, the word new immigrant, which referred not to all new immigrants, but to new immigrants from the new areas of Europe, which were poorer areas, starting to dominate the immigration stream around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. That term new immigrant kind of is very like the term white ethnic. It performed a lot of the same work, but with much more of a sense that these were peoples who were, as the book puts it, on trial in terms of whether they were racially fit to be part of the American experiment or not.
I'm speaking with David Roediger, a professor of history at the University of Illinois and author of Working Towards Whiteness, most recently. Also, you have a collection from Kerr that you'd like to say something about?
Yes, it's called History Against Misery, and it's a group of mostly published and some unpublished and obscurely published essays, the last half of which is actually about the critical study of whiteness.
Well, Kerr doesn't have quite the publicity machine that Basic does, so I apologize for not having more to say about that right now, but we will in the future. Now, there's a debate among historians about whether these new immigrants, those from Southern and Eastern Europe, were white on arrival or not. Could you review that debate?
Yeah, I think it's really a complicated debate, in part because race, as people in the United States use it, refers both to the category that people get slotted into and to how they think of themselves. So a judge might think you're white or not white, an immigration officer might think you're white or not white, and employer. And that's complicated for the new immigrants because there was a lot of division of opinion and a lot of situational applying of standards about are Sicilians white, are they white in this instance, et cetera. And then the second part of it, what you do with that as a new immigrant, what you know about race, do you think of yourself as white or as Sicilian or as Italian or as non-white? That's also a complicated question. But the way it's gotten talked about so far, I think, is useful in that the people, particularly Tom Guglielmo, who argue for the idea that Eastern and Southern Europeans were white on arrival, as he puts it, remind us that at law, where naturalization was concerned, where school segregation was concerned, mostly where Jim Crow was concerned, with some exceptions, that sort of daily life segregation, that Eastern and Southern Europeans were in a different situation than Mexican Americans, Asian Americans, and African Americans and American Indians. And I think that's a very useful reminder. What I'd append is that they were still in a racially charged situation. The term that I end up using most of the time is in-between peoples, and is a term that the late historian John Higham coined to describe Eastern and Southern Europeans' position, to emphasize that they're not non-white in the way that we usually talk about these things, but also not fully and always accepted as white either.
But there were some lynchings of Italians in the South, and I believe the Klan went on a rampage and drove Italians out of a part of Louisiana, right?
Right, right. And there were, when disfranchisement debates took place in the 1890s and the early 1900s in places like Maryland and Louisiana, there were always people who would get up and say, we do mean the Italians also. We do mean to deny the right to vote. And some of the mechanisms like poll taxes, insofar as people were poor, did deny the right to vote to immigrants. But in general, when people began to look at the actual Constitution and at law and at the systems of privilege that were in place, the conclusion was, no, Italian Americans may not be quite the sort of citizens that we had in mind when white supremacy was articulated, but they still get to vote. They still get to go to white schools, et cetera.
Yeah, I had a history teacher in high school who explained that the northern Italians were better because than the southern Italians because they'd intermarried with the Swiss. Got that in high school history.
Well, that's actually a very interesting point about the course of this book. One of the things that I had to learn was that it was important to pay attention to what people brought with them in terms of racial attitudes. And this split between a northern Italian race and a southern Italian race is very much also on the minds of Italians in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. Gramsci, of course, talks about the southern problem, but people far to the right of Gramsci were talking about Sicilians in a way very like the way that African American Southerners were talked about in the United States in this period. So one of the things that I had to grapple with was, what do those kind of racial distinctions, what kind of meanings do they have in Europe, and then how does anti-Gypsy racism, anti-Sicilian racism, anti-Semitism, how do those fit into learning the racial system in the United States when people come?
How much of this does really depend upon complexion? To some degree, it seems that the more a group resembles Africans, the more despised they are. Is that what's underlying all of this?
Well, I think an interesting way to get at that is to look at the court cases where the Supreme Court and lower courts are trying to decide who's white. Because at this time, people are claiming the right to be naturalized because they're white. That's the law. And often they will look exactly at complexion, especially in the lower courts. They'll have people roll up a shirt sleeve and say, you've been out in the sun, but what color really are you? And can the blue of a vein be seen on your upper arm through the skin? But then when it got to actual puzzling this out at the Supreme Court level, color varied so much among Europeans, and there was kind of an idea for some ethnographers, ethnologists, that there was a dark white race in Europe. And so the court would say, well, we can't really look at color, because then the Portuguese are going to be, and the Sicilians are going to be darker than some of the people that were racializing as non-white. So I think it's very much about color. Color is in people's minds, the African American as the touchstone of what's unacceptable as citizen. It's very much in people's minds as these court cases, for example, are make their way through the courts. But it's also an unreliable indicator when you're actually trying to make the laws.
Well, it seems also that that hating or feeling superior to African Americans is almost the lubricant for the whole whitening process. Is that really how it fundamentally works?
Yeah, I think that Toni Morrison says at one point that for her, the price of the ticket for the new immigrant kids that she actually grew up with, for her, the way that whiteness takes form for new immigrant children is to define blacks as the real aliens. So one's immigrant status can be lost around fitting into the culture as seeing African Americans as the permanent alien group.
There, you recount a fascinating race riot in Chicago, which I think was what Irish Americans dressed up in blackface and torched some homes of Eastern European immigrants, trying to blame blacks for that. What was the story?
Yeah, this was part of the great Chicago World War I era race riot. And one of the dramas of it was that an Irish, what's called a street gang at that time, but was actually a very important part of the Irish American Democratic Party political machine, a group called Reagan's Colts, noticed that in the riot, Eastern and Southern Europeans were sitting out the violence and weren't acting as whites and weren't participating in terror against African Americans, in part because they worked with African Americans in the packing houses. And so this street gang, which had been performing minstrel shows anyway in the neighborhood, put on blackface makeup and apparently went into Eastern European neighborhood and set fires, hoping that those fires would be blamed on African Americans, and then finally the Eastern Europeans would rally to the side of whiteness, both in the sense of victimizing African Americans in the riot, but also then in the sense of being tied to the Democratic Party and to Reagan's Colts as a political machine.
You mentioned minstrelsy. You write about it in this book, and also the wages of whiteness as being important in the creation of whiteness. How is that?
Well, very often, interestingly, Americanization, so-called, actually took place through minstrelsy. So the settlement houses in Chicago, for example, would put on minstrel shows, blackface minstrel shows, in which people put on black makeup and then caricatured different types of blackness and sang songs that were either Tin Pan Alley white songs or really African-American songs. So that the very first experience with U.S. culture, if you will, for a fair number of immigrants in settlement houses and also in lots of Catholic churches, Irish and German parishes that were taking in different immigrant groups, was this experience of blackface minstrelsy, already learning very, very subtle lessons about who could be made fun of and also who was fun in U.S. society. And one result of this is that many of the great minstrel performers in the 19th century were Irish Americans, and then in the 20th century were ethnic Americans, and particularly Jewish Americans. So that a film like The Jazz Singer, the great Al Jolson blockbuster, so-called first talking picture, is very much about Jolson's experience in blackface, and it's not an atypical new immigrant experience at all, with him bringing home American culture, but it's really African-American culture, but it's really this debased form of African-American culture that depends on blackface disguise.
And that was the first part of an interview with David Roediger, author of Working Towards Whiteness, just out from Basic Books. Let's take a break for station ID.
One little ID tag here.
Okay.
For a very important station in New York.
Hello, I'm Drew Barrymore. Sorry. I don't know, I don't like saying my name. No one says my name. It's the weirdest thing. I actually have two names. If you look up my social security number, you'll see that it says Drew Barrymore, a.k.a. Daisy Blythe. Hello, I'm Drew Barrymore. You're listening to WBAI, listener-sponsored community radio in New York City. WBAI needs your support. Please be generous, and thank you.
This is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Now let's listen to a bit more of Shostakovich's piano music performed by Keith Jarrett. And that was an excerpt from the Fugue No. 2 for piano by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Keith Jarrett. And now let's listen to the second half of my interview with David Roediger, who teaches history at the University of Illinois. His new book is called Working Towards Whiteness.
Let's put ourselves in the position of a new immigrant from Southern or Eastern Europe, arriving in the United States late 19th, early 20th century. What kind of housing conditions and labor market conditions would he or she confront?
In terms of labor market conditions. Originally, in some cities, new immigrants actually, on average, made the same or less than African Americans. Now, it's a tough comparison because the African Americans had been in these cities now for decades, in many cases, had social capital in the form of English and skills in particular factories. But originally, there was this kind of rough parity at the bottom of society. And then there's a moving up by the new immigrants to semi-skilled and what I'm calling in-between racial status. And always a tremendous emphasis by management on racial types. The great founder of labor history in the United States, John R. Cummins, once said that not Taylorism, not scientific management, but the management of races was what the distinctive U.S. contribution to management theory was. And in the early 20th century, as you read management literature, you can easily believe this. Managers put forward their qualifications in terms of knowing about what races, and again, there were lots of races, including lots of European races, were fit for what jobs. Now, the housing one is enormously important, and this book was actually originally called, I wrote it always thinking it was going to be called Getting Into the White House, because the house is so important in the book, and Basic decided they wanted no puns in the title, so it ends up being called something different. But the house still is the glue that ties a lot of chapters together, because out of terrible housing, new immigrants came to, and out of their own values from Europe, came to really want their own houses. And so the poorest sectors of the immigrant working class often hit homeowning rates greater than native-born middle-class people in big cities in the United States. And it's around cherishing those homes that the new immigrants really get brought into whiteness. So that in the 1920s, at the very time when Congress is saying, is passing immigration restriction legislation and saying that Eastern and Southern Europeans are not racially fit, they're explicitly saying they're too low in IQs to be part of the United States, and they can't come. At that same moment, locally, those same groups of people are being asked into restrictive covenant campaigns to create white neighborhoods and are using African Americans, as you said, as the lubricant to create this white identity, so that nationally excluded, locally included, but specifically locally included around the idea of a White House. And then what the New Deal does is takes that idea of the White House and makes it state policy and makes it the object of subsidies, so that the New Deal's housing policy recognizes restrictive covenants, recognizes ghettoization, and subsidizes moves to white suburbs, in some ways almost requires moves to white suburbs by the children of new immigrants, and takes and invents redlining, invents the discrimination by mapping against black and Latino communities, is a New Deal invention. So that housing really becomes a pivot of a lot of the learning of whiteness and cherishing of whiteness for Eastern and Southern Europeans.
Your chapter on the New Deal will not make pleasant reading for a lot of people who are nostalgic for that era. It was a very white and whitening process, you say. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think people think of the Democratic Party during the New Deal as creating the very first glimmers of white working class, black unity. And in some ways it did do that. And in some ways it's right to say that unity was held hostage to the fact that the party also had this huge racist Southern wing. But another dynamic is that the New Deal was finally delivering full social citizenship to Eastern and Southern Europeans. And that I think in many ways its historic task and its social base was the Eastern and Southern European voter, and the task was to bring them to full citizenship rights. And so already built into it, not just along a north-south divide, but along divides in the north and in western cities, was this idea that the New Deal was giving things to Eastern and Southern European immigrants and their children that it was at the same moment denying to African Americans and Latinos. And I've mentioned housing. Housing is the very best example. But it's also true that the Social Security Act was propagated in such a way to exclude a huge majority of African American and Latino workers, even as it included almost all Eastern and Southern European workers. The Fair Labor Standards Act, the same way. The Wagner Act, the Labor Relations Act, denied the NAACP's demand that discrimination by unions be an unfair, racial discrimination be an unfair labor practice. So in very many ways, the act of inclusion into the CIO and into the New Deal of powerful secondary leaders and an empowered rank and file who were Eastern and Southern Europeans was an acknowledgement of their whiteness. And actually, structurally, the Democratic Party in the New Deal not only included a Northern and Southern wing, not only included big business and working people at the same time, but it also included a very, very fractured working class, and it didn't attempt to heal those fractures.
You've mentioned employers who are very adept at racializing job categories and pitting one group against another and such. So in some sense, some of this racialization was imposed from above, but on the other hand, the immigrants themselves had a hand in it. How much agency should we give to the new immigrants in creating this this category of whiteness, which was then directed against black Americans?
It's a really interesting question, and it's another one on which James Baldwin has been my guide. And Baldwin said the choice of whiteness, the buying into what he called the price of the ticket of United States whiteness on the part of new immigrants was, he said, absolutely a moral choice, that it was something that individuals on one level, however unthinking the decision or however clear the advantages, morally decided. But then he almost in the next sentence says it was a choice made under, as he puts it, a vast amount of coercion. And so this thing like the fact that you could get a home loan to move to a whites-only neighborhood or a whites-only suburb and you couldn't get one to live in a mixed neighborhood also coerces new immigrants and their children to behave in certain ways. Baldwin says in one arresting image that new immigrants were trapped in a whiteness factory. And he clearly, you know, understands that they're also trapped in factories. And that there was this very desperate need to grasp whatever kind of advantage could be grasped. But he doesn't lose track of the fact that there's also self-activity. There's also, particularly in the restrictive covenants, unfair housing activities in the 1920s, a very, very stark moral choice being made.
I was speaking with David Roediger, author of Working Towards Whiteness. Reading the book, I kept being struck over and over again by the endless capacity of American society to renew its brutality and competitiveness. It seems to be one of the organizing principles of our society. So in some sense, people were thrust into this horrific Darwinian machine, right? Mm-hmm. But is there some other way that they could have reacted? I know it's hard to do counterfactual history, but is there another way of imagining this history developing?
I am a labor historian, and I think about the labor movement mostly, and I think about particularly in this year, the centennial year of the Industrial Workers of the World. I think that it provides something of a counter model that, you know, worked in certain locales at certain times. And people talk about the IWW as being a model of black-white unity. In places like Philadelphia, for example, where the waterfront was unionized, or in places like Louisiana, where timber was unionized by the IWW. But in many ways, it wasn't really black-white unity. It was black-Polish unity, or black-Slavic unity, or on some docks, Irish-black-Polish unity in the Piney Woods in Louisiana and in timbering, it was Italian-Mexican-black unity. And so I think that there was a moment in which the racial categories were more fluid. The assumption by the union, in the case of the Industrial Workers of the World, that its main base was white, and that it had to first of all appeal to white workers and then incorporate other workers around the edges of this appeal to a base that assumed a white male worker as the main organizing subject. There were places where that assumption wasn't made, and some interesting things happened in those places. They happened in ways that could not be sustained, and that probably speaks to the power of what Baldwin called the vast amount of coercion that was also going on. But I think you do see some places and some religious leaders, for example, some parts of the Jewish community, who try for a long time to think about what Jewish-Black unity would look like, and don't only make the assumption that there's an easy equation between anti-Jewish prejudice in the United States and anti-Black prejudice in the United States, but really try to wrestle with the complexities involved.
Well, this is all seems very naturalized to us now, and most people have, even highly educated people, have really forgotten this history of whiteness. It's just not, doesn't have much currency, despite the efforts of people like you to make it current again. So, how do we deal with this problem of whiteness today? I heard a story once about Ted Allen getting into a cab and being addressed by a white cab driver as a fellow white person, and he said, well, I'm not white, but that doesn't seem very promising.
To say, you must be mistaking me for a white person.
But, you know, what is there a way out of this, this trap of white consciousness?
Well, I think that involves that these problems were structurally made. When I talk about the New Deal and housing policy, you probably know the figures better than I, but some of the figures seem to suggest that Black families on average have about 1/7 of the wealth of African Americans. Oliver and Shapiro seem to say maybe only 1/10 at this time. Meanwhile, the incarceration rates for Black men and Latino men are 7 times as high as those for white young men. As long as those kinds of inequalities persist, and we have 300 years of habit of national race thinking, I think it's very unlikely that any kind of demographic change or immigration or any one thing will automatically undermine the racial system, and particularly the force of anti-Black racism in the United States. So for me, those kinds of voluntary opting out of whiteness, like the Ted Allen in the cab story, are important, and important to give young white people in particular a way to think about the fact that they don't have to identify as white. My friend Franklin Rosemont says to disillusion young whites in their whiteness. But as long as we don't take up the structural aspects, as long as Black neighborhoods are made to look like they look by the system we're living under, I think it's going to be very hard for voluntarism to undermine our national racial notions.
Do you think the process of whitening now could be extended in our time to newer groups of immigrants, some Latin American immigrants, even some Asian immigrants? Can the category of whiteness be plastic enough to include these even newer immigrants than the ones we were talking about earlier?
One of the things that struck me in doing the research for this book is that we live with these constant predictions that in some year, 2047, the United States will become a minority white nation. And sometimes that's put forward as panic, and sometimes it's put forward as race is over, and so we don't really need to think too much about these issues. They're going to take care of themselves by intermarriage and immigration. Exactly the same kind of predictions existed in the 1890s about the middle of the 20th century, that the United States was about to lose its racial character, that whiteness, or at least Anglo-Saxon whiteness, was going to be swamped. But the problem for those predictors, for the Census Bureau at that time, was Eastern and Southern Europeans, was Poles and Greeks and Eastern European Jews and Italians. And so somewhere along the line, those groups became incorporated as fully white. Now, I think that that's possible in the new century. I don't know that it's necessary. We all know that there are lots of white supremacist societies with white minorities. Virtually every colonial state had that pattern. It's arguable that South Africa has it now. And it may only be necessary to have new immigrating groups define themselves as non-Black rather than be accepted as white or consider themselves as white. So I think that all of that, what the 19th to 20th century example reveals is that these are political questions. What, how race takes shape in the next 50 years are questions that are going to be answered along the lines of how can we organize? If there's a powerful Black Latino political movement making demands that transform, as Mike Davis hopes, the whole of society, well, then it's going to be much less likely that Cubans, for example, decide to cast their lot with whiteness. You see this with so-called triracial groups in the South that always tried to be apart from African Americans in various locations. And then when the Black Freedom Movement hit, very often they came straight to the Black Freedom Movement. So Moja Three Rivers says race is a political alliance. Whiteness is in particular is a political alliance. And I think that the answer to how that political alliance takes shape lies in our self-activity.
And that was David Roediger, author of Working Towards Whiteness and a professor of history at the University of Illinois, in an interview recorded last week. A factual clarification of some points David Roediger was making about income and wealth inequalities by race. It's well known that white households have average incomes that are almost twice as high as Black households, but the gap in wealth, holding of assets like houses, bank accounts, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, is far wider. On average, white households are 7 or 8 times as wealthy as Black ones. Even if you look at households with similar incomes, educational backgrounds, and occupations, the Black-white racial gap is quite wide. The major reason for this is that white families typically have some wealth to pass on to their heirs, and Black families don't. Some scholars have called this the sedimentation of privilege. That gap may narrow over time, but it's going to take a really, really long time for that to happen. Anyway, I review all this info in my book, After the New Economy, which is just out in paperback from the New Press. And by the way, I agree with what Roediger said towards the end of his interview about how a voluntary denial of whiteness won't do the trick when material inequities are so profound. But there is a chicken-egg problem here. Surveys repeatedly show that white people think that members of other races, particularly African Americans, have it pretty good. And men, by the way, often say the same about women. The civil rights movement and feminism accomplished their goals, according to the privileged half of those equations. That's palpably not true, but as long as white people and men believe these things, it's going to be hard to get any political traction for the kinds of policies, income redistribution, affirmative action, anti-discrimination enforcement, prison reform. It's going to be hard to get the kinds of support we need politically that could change these material realities. So that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back once again on recording next week with Ian Boll and Barbara Ehrenreich. So stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with a bit more of Shostakovich performed by Keith Jarrett, the Fugue No. 7. Bye.